Friday, March 12th, 2410. The last of the guests began arriving early Friday morning, before anyone in the wedding party was even out of bed. All the drilling and training in logistics and etiquette that Utena and Suabuki had subjected the student volunteers to paid off, as the assembly of the wedding venue and the wrangling of the great volume of last day arrivals all went off without a hitch and without any need for direct supervision by the wedding party themselves. Cora was up at 8 o'clock, despite her fairly late turn-in time. After a bit of meditation and a quick shower, she was ready to face at least the first part of the day. She dressed in regular street clothes, figuring she'd have plenty of time to get changed before the main event, picked up her Savoy book, and headed down to the refectory to see if there was anything doing for breakfast. There was, and there were a handful of duelists and friends breakfasting there already. A few more filtered in while she sat at the far end of the main table, working on a bowl of cereal, a glass of lychee juice, and some toast with one hand while catching up on the news from back home via the Sipang VPN gateway. Nothing much going on, which was good. No news, as ever, was good news when she was out and about. The last thing she wanted was for the White Lotus to be able to point out some stupid thing that would have happened anyway and tell her they told her so when she got back. She was flipping through the sports section of the Republic City Tribune's website, checking up on the spring training results in both baseball and pro bending, when something large and furry loomed up on her right and broke her concentration with a cold, wet nose. Even now, so many years after her old friend had, as she preferred to think of it, left to scout out the spirit world ahead of her, Cora's unconscious reaction to this was to remark, "Ah, Naga, stop," and fend the creature off without looking. Only when her hand met a much coarser pelt than Naga's sleek white coat did she blink, look, and say, "Oh, right. Good morning, Durin."
"Durin!" Natsuki cried from the doorway. "Again! What is wrong with you?"
Rushing over, she gestured the wolf angrily to heel, then said to Cora, "I'm sorry about that. Again." Managing a wry little smile, she went on, "You were certainly right about having a way with animals." "Actually, that was a really nostalgic moment," said Cora, petting the shame-faced wolf with an indulgent smile. "I can understand being concerned about pet control," she went on to Natsuki. "But don't get too upset on my account. I've been glomped by way bigger animals." She chuckled. "You want to really wake up in the morning sometime, get licked by a sky bison you didn't hear coming up behind you."
"I'm sorry, a what?" asked Shizuru curiously as she arrived behind Natsuki. "I think I missed the beginning."
"Sky bison," Cora said. "They're... well, here, I'll show you." She slid down a little bit along the table so that Natsuki and Shizuru had room to sit on either side of her, then pulled over her laptop and opened up her photo archive. Clicking quickly through pictures of unfamiliar scenes and people, she muttered, "No, no, I really ought to organize these things better. Come on, where are you? Wait, there's Iki, so these must be Air Temple..." "Aha! Here we are." She clicked the picture she'd found to full-screen display. "See? Sky bison. This one's called Mogi."
"That's impressively big," Natsuki admitted, regarding the photo. It showed a huge and shaggy animal, roughly the size of a bus, standing next to, honestly looming over, a white-haired but spry-looking woman dressed in saffron and yellow.
"Fascinating," said Shizuru. "They have six legs."
"Yes, they do," agreed Cora.
"Why are they called sky bison?" Natsuki wondered.
"Because they can fly," Cora said, as though that were the most natural explanation in the world.
When Natsuki responded to this with a skeptical look, she grinned and clicked to the next picture. "There we are.
a rare shot of Mogi in action. She grinned and explained, "He's been scientifically proven to be the laziest sky bison in the world." The new photo did indeed show the same creature, indisputably engaged in something that looked very much like flight. It appeared to be an aerial photo, showing the bison, with the white-haired woman perched cheerfully just abaft its head, at a fairly respectable altitude over a sunlit harbor, the skyline of a large city spread out in the distance beyond it. "I think I want to be a paleontologist on your homeworld," said Shizuru slowly as she regarded this photo. "It would be very interesting to determine how such a thing evolved. Assuming they aren't engineered?" she inquired. Cora shook her head. "Nope, they're all natural. Sky bison are the original airbenders. They're who the air nomads learned from." "That sentence made absolutely no sense," Natsuki observed matter-of-factly. "I suspect we're missing the cultural background, Natsuki," Shizuru told her mildly. "My apologies, Cora." With an impish smile, she added, "As you saw last night, I can't take her anywhere." "You can't take me anywhere?" Natsuki objected. "No need. You're both right," said Cora. "Sorry, I haven't left home in a while. I'm not used to being around people who don't already have the backstory. See, it all ties into the answer to the question you asked me last night that we didn't have time for. And we still kind of don't," she added with a grin. "But I can give you the short version anyway, if you've got a couple of minutes." Shizuru smiled. "I'd like nothing better." At the other end of the table, the Trinity had drifted in about 8:45, while Cora was still on the sports page. This would have been catastrophically late on any normal wedding day, but none of them seemed concerned as they waved good mornings to various friends, took their seats, and started in on breakfast. "Been thinking about what you said last night," Corwin said to Utrina as he buttered his waffles. "Which part?" Utrina wondered, sweetening her coffee. "About the other girls I know." "Oh, ah. And?" "And I don't really know," Corwin said, shrugging. He poured syrup, then put the little pot of it back in its rack in the middle of the table and said, "I mean, Achika was always going to be Len's girl. We all knew that before any of us even knew what it meant." He sawed off a waffle corner. "Dorothy was my friend, and definitely a girl, but also my responsibility. Reyna and I just aren't each other's type. The Valkyrie were part of the background hum. Buttercup was kind of scary sometimes. And Konami's just always been Konami." "I don't know." He grinned at her. "I guess I don't have an answer for you." Utrina grinned back, then gestured with her chin to the far end of the table, where Cora was by now deep in conference with Shizuru and Natsuki over something on her teak and brass laptop. "What about her?" Corwin looked at her as though she'd gone out of focus. "Who, Cora?" he asked, as though there were someone else over there Utrina could possibly mean. No. "Why not, though?" Utrina wondered. Then went on with a cajoling grin. "I mean, seriously. I'd seen her in your photo albums before, obviously, but pictures don't do her justice. They can't capture the dynamism of her, the... She made a gesture to Anthy. "Help me out here." "The two-fisted how much funness," Anthy suggested, smiling. Utrina recognized that her wife was in a puckishly unhelpful mood and cut her losses with a smiling nod. "That'll do," she said. Corwin knew he was at least partially being teased at this point, and decided to tease back. "Hmm," he said, as if seriously considering the question. He regarded his old friend, now having an animated conversation with Shizuru involving fighter pilot-style so-I-flew-it-like-this gestures, thoughtfully, then said, "You know, you're right. She is pretty awesome.
Leaning back in his seat, he went on as if warming to the idea. She's smart, she's tough, she's funny, she's good times. She could totally keep up with me, and geez, I mean, just look at her.
He nodded appreciatively.
Yep, she is the complete package, all right. All anybody with a working brain or heart could ever want.
Kutrina's grin slipped slightly into I may have opened that door a little too wide territory.
Oh, said Corwin, as if just remembering something. And she was there when I was born.
Kutrina gave him a curious look.
What, as in the room?
As in standing about there, said Corwin, pointing to a theoretical spot about 2 feet away, practicing the ancient and honorable Southern Water Tribe art of midwifery.
Oh.
Utina blinked.
Oh.
Oh.
Anthe giggled.
Nall too? She asked.
Nall too, Corwin confirmed, then added with a wry laugh. Don't you figure that explains a few things?
Tuesday, June 25th, 2391. Nakomi Koka, Tomodachi. The small, bedraggled white creature, not particularly avian-looking apart from its soggy wings, finished wrestling its way out of its egg, then flopped full length on the slab of ice on which that egg lay, and heaved a sigh of equal parts relief and exhaustion. Then, to Cora's momentary astonishment, he spoke in a high, clear voice.
That was hard, the dragon hatchling remarked, evidently to himself. And I'm all wet, and it's freezing in here.
He got unsteadily to his feet, blinking around at the newly entered world.
Oh, well. One out of three's not... Oh, hello.
You talk? Said a beautiful, brown-skinned, blue-eyed woman, whose face was thus the first intelligible thing the young dragon saw. Then, smiling, she went on before he could reply,
You're a dragon. Of course you talk. Hi.
Without further preamble, she wrapped him up in a warm, fluffy towel. Learning experience number two. Not being cold is also pretty good, and gave him a comprehensive cuddle while scrubbing his head dry.
I'm Cora, and what's your name?
The dragonette blinked thoughtfully.
Haven't got one yet.
Utina laughed, then sobered and said,
Speaking of Nall, isn't he back yet?
Corwin shrugged. No sign of him so far that I know of, he said. I figured after breakfast I'd organize a search party.
No need, came a familiar voice from the doorway.
Everyone in the refectory turned to see Nall, in his white-haired but youthful human form, entering the room, looking disheveled and tired. Behind him came the rest of the group which had left Sephiro the night before, looking in similar condition. And they had Umiri Ozaki with them. No better off than any of the others.
Morning, everyone, said Nall with an absent wave for the room as he trudged toward the head of the main table.
As he passed Cora, he bent and gave her a kiss on the cheek without breaking stride, remarking, Hey, gorgeous. Then, reaching Corwin's side at last, he slumped to the bench next to him and said,
What's up, guys?
Sorry, no wedding today.
Best man's too tired to... man... bestly.
He blinked blearily at a bowl one of the dining hall attendants placed before him.
Is that oatmeal?
He asked, then slumped face first to the table, and not into the oatmeal, only because Anthe reached and hastily moved it aside, and began snoring.
He just needs a nap, said Umi apologetically.
We all need a nap, Hikaru complained.
While various people gathered around and tried, all at once and without much success, to find out what had happened to the group,
Cora sidled around until she stood between Corwin and Nall's seats, then bent down and closely examined the side of Nall's face that wasn't pressed flat against the tabletop. "So, this is Nall," she said, as if still processing the idea.
"Uh-huh," said Corwin.
"Nall has a human form."
"Yeah. Didn't he ever mention it?"
"No," said Cora lightly. "No, I'm afraid it must have completely slipped his mind to mention that he's capable of assuming human form now. There must not have been a good time to bring it up."
She put her hands on her hips. "For instance, last night during the game, when he was climbing into my lap."
She gestured to the pitcher standing in the middle of the table, drew the water out of it, shaped it into a ball, and poised it over Nall's head, keeping it in place and in shape with the delicate, rhythmic motion of one hand.
"Anybody need him woken up?" she asked with a slightly nasty smile.
With a vaguely affronted frown, Umi stepped between Hikaru and Fu to reach the table on the other side of Nall, passed her hand over the water sphere, and murmured quickly under her breath, "Spirits of the North, let this water be as crystal or stone."
Cora blinked, startled, as the water instantly froze solid. Umi plucked it from the air and set it back in the pitcher.
"Leave him be," said Umi testily. "He's had a difficult morning."
Okay, replied Cora, bemused.
"Doing what, Umi?"
Anthy wanted to know, but Umi only shook her head.
"I'll explain later," she said. "It's not important right now."
She turned to Utrina and Corwin. "What is important is that you two need to get dressed, unless you plan to get married on a baseball diamond."
"Say, that's an idea," said Utrina offhandedly. But Umi ignored her and, shouldering her way none too diplomatically past Cora, leaned to speak into Nall's ear.
No one heard what she said, but a moment later he quivered, then seemed to collapse into his familiar flying cat form, which she picked up and arranged, still asleep, on her shoulder.
"He'll get more out of his nap this way," she said to Cora's puzzled look. With a fond, tired smile, she dropped her mostly affected dudgeon and petted the little dragon's head tenderly.
"I'm sorry I was rude."
"To us," she said, gesturing to the wilted little group she'd come in with. "This is the end of a long day. You must be his friend Cora. I've heard so much about you. I'm Umi Ryuzaki."
"Oh," said Cora, "of course." She made the water tribe salute again, fist in hand, and bowed slightly.
"I am Cora, yes, and I wasn't really going to get him wet, at least not for long."
She reached and gave Nall a little scritching of her own.
"He did fail to mention his human form, though.
At least now," she added archly, "I have a better idea what he meant when he said you were his very special friend."
Umi went a little bit red.
"Did he?" she said with exaggerated casualness. "Well..."
Then, turning back to Corwin and Utna, she resumed some of her previous bossiness and snapped, "What are you still doing here? Go get ready!"
"Eh, it's a waste of time," said Wakaba before either could speak. She slid onto the bench beside Utna, an arm over her shoulders, and said,
"I didn't realize it before, but I can see clearly now that this marriage is doomed before it begins. Might's well not bother."
"What?" said approximately everyone awake, within earshot.
"Wakaba," Utrina growled, twisting out from under her old friend's arm to glare at her.
"It's obvious," Wakaba said, gesturing to the shocked pair. "Look at them. It'll be a mixed marriage."
She picked up Utrina's coffee and sipped it casually.
"Never gonna work."
Utrina and Corwin looked at each other, completely baffled, then realized what she was getting at and broke up laughing, as did Wakaba, Anthy, and, after a moment more's befuddled consideration, Cora and Fu. It took Hikaru, who was, after all, tired and not that good at identifying subtexts at her most alert, a few seconds longer, but, unlike Umi, who was in no mood, and Tsuwabuki and Izumi, who lacked the proper background to get the joke at all, she pieced it together in time as well. Both Utena and Corwin were wearing baseball jerseys, home team white, with the numbers of favorite players on the back. Utena's was, of course, number 46 of the Boston Red Sox, who, since time immemorial, had not put their names on their home uniforms. The number of pitcher Consuela Coco Martinez, the hero of the 2404 World Series, and still a key part of that team's starting rotation. Corwin's, on the other hand, was that of number 15, Delia Petrovskaya, the hard-charging, evidently indestructible second basewoman of the New Avalon Knights. "That was mean, Wakaba," Hikaru sighed when she'd finished laughing. "It was mean," Utena agreed, rising, "and it's going in your permanent record." She reached down and mussed her friend's auburn hair. "Anyway, Umi's right. Time to dress for the show. You ready, Rocket Boy?" "Anywhere, anytime," Corwin replied, getting to his feet. Bowing to his friends, he added with a smile, "Don't wander off. Good stuff coming up in a bit." The guests, half-jokingly referred to on the manifest as the token grown-ups, started arriving at a little after 10 and, along with those who had already arrived, needed to be seated. Out on the quad, Carden Feltz and his crack team of chair deployers had completed the conversion in record time, just at the moment when the Einherjar ushers arrived from Valhalla and began that process. It was all running like clockwork. Watching the process from the sidelines, Lindsay Willows turned to Tsuwabuki and asked him, "How did you ever get all these people back together in one place, let alone here, on such short notice?" Tsuwabuki grinned. "Wasn't easy," he said. Monday, March 8th, 2410. Nekomikoka, Tomodachi. "Gentlemen," said Skold Ravenhair cheerfully, "thanks for coming. I have a little job for you." Sitting at either end of Skold's living room sofa, her guests, a stocky man in jeans and a cream cable-knit sweater, and a skinny specimen in a brown pinstripe suit, glanced at each other and shared a private smile. When Skold said that, they both knew, it could mean anything from a field test of some wackily harmless piece of equipment to a full-dress pan-galactic emergency. "Corwin and Utena have decided to make the second attempt at their wedding sooner rather than later," Skold went on. "This is a good thing on many levels, but it does leave us with a slight logistical problem. As such," she went on, glancing from one man to the other, "I'm afraid that for take two, I'm going to have to ask you to do more than just show up." "I thought that might be the case," said Don Griffin with a smile. Skold nodded. "Here's the guest list," she said, handing him a datapad. "We need all those people on site by 10 o'clock Avalon Standard Time this Friday morning, the 12th. The problem is," she added, grinning, "not all of those people are available at 10 o'clock Avalon Standard Time this Friday morning. That's where you come in." "Ooh," the doctor mused, thumbing down the list. "That could get complicated." He looked up from the datapad. "Where are we taking them? Babylon 6 again? Ooh, could get very complicated." Skold shook her head. "No, they've decided on a different location for the second attempt. Someplace where there's much less chance of fouling anybody's timeline if you have to collect them from earlier in the week." She handed each Time Lord a data module. "You'll need these." "What are they?" the doctor wondered, eyeing his. "Coordinates for the Veil Gate Corwin and I are building in Sephiro," Skold told him. "Don't transpose any digits or you'll crash into the crystal sphere." The doctor and Don looked at each other, then grinned.
With 45 minutes or so to go before the ceremony was set to begin, Amy Pond and Rory Williams were taking the opportunity to have another look around the campus. It was a beautiful day, the weather brilliantly clear and unseasonably balmy, with a pleasant edge of springtime cool still in the air. Hand in hand, they were crossing the little round plaza in front of the White Tower, just enjoying being at large and together in a place as pleasant as this, when they suddenly stopped, glancing first around and then at each other. At the same moment, they both heard an unusual but instantly familiar sound. Without hesitation, they dove for cover, piling behind the wisteria, and from this vantage point watched as the bulky blue shape of a London police call box appeared in the middle of the courtyard. A moment later, the door opened and a tall man in a brown coat emerged, beckoning cheerfully for others to follow. "Right this way, step lively now," he said in a vague impression of a carnival barker. "Mind your step." Laughing, a bleach-blonde young woman in a letterman's jacket edged past the stream of slightly baffled-looking wedding guests who were emerging to help him point people at the quad. "Well," Rory mused quietly, "that's definitely Rose. I don't recognize him, but who else could he be?" Amy nodded. "It's the Doctor, an earlier model. I've seen this one before." "Where?" Rory wondered. "In Pompeii." Rory gave her a puzzled look. "When were you in Pompeii?" Amy rolled her eyes at him. "Guess." He accepted this as his due, then said, "No, I mean, I don't remember exactly," she said. "You weren't with me on that one. I assumed you were in Gaul or something." "Hmm," said Rory thoughtfully. "Alone in AD 79. Cappadocia, I think." "Anyway, he didn't notice me," Amy told him. Rory nodded and watched Rose Tyler and the Doctor cheerfully direct traffic. A few moments later, slightly to the pair's surprise, another TARDIS, this one in the shape of a Pepsi vending machine, arrived next to the Doctor's. From this one emerged a smiling, stocky man in a long green coat, and a slim brunette with what appeared to be a small purple dragon perched on her shoulder. "We know you have a choice in interdimensional time travel," said the man in green cheerfully, as another group of guests emerged from his TARDIS in his wake. "And we'd like to thank you for choosing the Time Lords. We hope to see you all again." "In a few hours, when you need to get back home," Rose finished for him, and, laughing, they high-fived. "Look at how young she is," Rory murmured. Amy nodded. "Long before our time. We're all out of sequence. Best we try not to be noticed." "Historically, you have a harder time with that than I do," Rory observed wryly. She swatted at his shoulder, and together they slipped away. Corwin's parents arrived at 10:30, having been jokingly requested to keep themselves out from underfoot until as late as possible. They came by the Rose Gate, not with one of the Time Lords, and so they came down the stairs from the Forest of Secrets rather than up from the lower campus. They arrived to find the quad engulfed in an orderly hubbub, with dress-uniformed Einherjar and Tenjo Academy student volunteers managing everything smoothly and calmly. The moment they reached the bottom of the stairs, Wolfgang, Beagle of the Lens, left Griffin's side and darted straight for the front of the seating section on the left. For a second, Griffin wondered who the Lens Hound was in such a hurry to say hello to. There was any number of candidates here today. The one of the main ones, Utina herself, wouldn't be in evidence out here just yet. A moment later, he had his answer, as a figure broke away from a conversation with the Shannon twins to hunker down and greet the dog. Laughing, Griffin and Scold crossed to wait their turn. "Who's a good Lens Beagle? You're a good Lens Beagle," said Cora, scruffling the furiously wagging hound. "Yes, you are," Yes, you are.
Then, straightening up, she spread her hands in welcome and declared, Griff! She considered giving Corwin's father the same kind of hug she'd greeted the son with upon her arrival in Sephiro, but as they were both fully decked out for the wedding at this point, and she'd already had to discreetly airbend some beagle hair off her dress, she decided against it.
Remind me, she said, grinning, and Griffin nodded, knowing what she meant.
Look at you, he said, taking her in. He had known Cora for nearly 19 years now, all of Corwin's life, and he could count the number of times he'd seen her dressed in anything fancier than a t-shirt and jeans on one hand. Admittedly, they'd only seen each other every 6 or 8 months before the recent 6-year drought, so his statistical sampling was not all that large. All the same, the sight of the rough-and-tumble avatar in the traditional finery of her native South Pole, all rich dark blue fabrics and spotless white fur trim, with a gleaming gem like a piece of polished ice below the notch of her high collar, was atypical enough that Griffin just had to admire it for a moment. She had her hair done differently, too, mostly down and back, with a jaunty little white cap of a type the name of which he couldn't remember. Wolfgang ran a lap around her feet, then sped off to say hello to Serge.
You guys shine up pretty well, too, said Cora, gesturing with a grin to Griffin's IPO dress uniform and Skuld's radiantly white and scarlet Asgardian robes.
Of course I knew Skuld would. She's a woman of class and distinction, she added with a wink. But you're usually such a disreputable character. I half expected you to show up in jeans and an old rock t-shirt.
For which neither Corwin nor Utrina would fault me, Griffin pointed out. But I suspect Anthy would disapprove, and I know Bell would.
And you don't want to risk that, Cora agreed.
So how have you guys been? It's been ages.
Corwin and Nall already gave me a hard time about that, by the way, she added wryly.
And well they should, Skuld remarked, grinning.
Cora shrugged ruefully.
Yeah, well, not exactly my choice, but let's not get into that right now.
Griffin nodded. Can't complain, he said. Busy, but you know how that goes.
Brother, do I ever, Cora agreed as they crossed back toward the first row of chairs.
Then she hesitated, feeling a momentary discomfort. There was something she felt she needed to say, sooner rather than later, but she was reluctant to risk the cheerful mood by raising it. On the other hand, if she left it, it would just get more and more awkward to bring up later. And anyway, if there was anyone who would understand, it was this man. So, pitching her voice so it wouldn't carry to the crowd they were approaching, she put a hand on his arm and said,
I'm sorry about Kay. Corwin told me in one of his letters. I know it's well after the fact now, but if there's anything I can do...
Griffin smiled, only a little sadly, and patted her hand on his arm.
Thanks, he said. It's been tough, but I'm getting by, with a lot of help from my friends.
Caitlin arrived on the quad shortly before her father, and after finding her seat and posting Sergei to mind it, she made her way over to the space off to the right, where the Tenjo Academy Student Orchestra was setting up. She had been repeatedly assured that she would get to take this particular occasion off, that everything was under control. And she didn't doubt it. She'd heard Tenjo Academy's orchestra before, and she knew it was a quality ensemble. So it wasn't out of some sense of territoriality or a desire to interfere that she went over there. She just wanted to scope things out a little, maybe chat with their director, see if there was anything she could offer in the way of help or advice without being too overbearing about it. After all, she and Miki had written most of the music they were going to be performing. When she arrived at the little riser on which the conductor's podium had been erected, though, she saw that there was no need whatever for concern. Tenjo Academy's student director, standing so that Kate had her in slightly less than profile,
was unmistakable to her. A tall, slim girl with very curly, dark brown hair falling heavily about her dress-uniformed shoulders. Head bent in concentration at a very familiar angle over her master score, the long, slender woodwind player's fingers of her right hand idly twiddling her conductor's baton as she read. Seeing this young woman poring over her compositions, Caitlin knew they were in good hands, hands she knew well and could trust, because she had, in large part, trained them.
Heather, she blurted, so shocked that she stumbled over the first phoneme in a way that had become rare for her of late.
The girl at the podium straightened and turned to face Kate, her fair-skinned, dark-eyed face breaking into a wide smile.
"Caitlin, it's good to see you," said Heather McClellan, stepping down to embrace her.
"Surprised to see me?" she asked, her smile becoming a touch mischievous.
"Very," said Kate. "I thought you'd gone to Hotohori."
"I did, for a year," said Heather. "But word reached me about this place's university division last summer, and I thought, well, that sounds interesting. I already don't speak Japanese worth a damn. What's one more step outside my comfort zone?"
Kate laughed. Heather had been 1 year behind her in high school, and was the most talented clarinetist she had ever known. She'd been first chair in WPI's extremely competitive student orchestra from the day she arrived on campus, which, it occurred to Kate now, was the same day Utena did. When the school folded at the tumultuous end of that school year, she'd been one of the few Earthborn students to make the leap to Satori Mandeville Memorial for the next. The following spring, she'd been among the first volunteers to play at Utena and Anthe's wedding in Asgard. Fearless, musically dedicated, and always willing to try anything twice, in case not liking the first time was a fluke, she had been part of the backbone of Kate's orchestras right through the latter's 2407 graduation, then succeeded Kate for her own senior year. Kate had just decided not to mention that she'd passed up Hotohori University's offer of a scholarship to their Conservatory of Music, in large part because they would have ousted Heather from her post in that program to make way for her, when Heather brought it up herself. "Besides, Hotohori's trustees were getting ready to demote me and hand my orchestra over to some upstart transfer student from Nekomi Tech. I mean, I ask you." Putting her fists on her hips, she went on, "Was I supposed to just stay there and put up with that kind of treatment?"
Well, said Kate awkwardly, but then Heather laughed and clapped her on the shoulder.
"Relax. I know it was you they were making an offer to," she said, "and I figured you wouldn't go for it. But, you know, a front office that would even consider such a thing."
Kate nodded. "I wrote them a very touchy letter about it," she said. "Which must have stung all the more when you'd already taken another offer yourself," she added with a smile.
"One can hope," said Heather airily, "but it would probably be petty. At any rate, if you get a chance to talk to your brother before I do, thank him for me, will you? It's a great honor for an outworlder like me to be called on at a moment like this. Mind you," she added, tapping the score with her baton, "with material this good to work with, it'd be hard for anyone to screw it up."
"Flatterer," said Kate. "I'll leave you to it, but congratulations, Heather. You deserve it."
"Yes, I do," Heather replied positively. Then she giggled and hugged Kate again.
"Thanks. Now, I'm under strict orders to keep you off the risers during the ceremony and the dancing after lunch, so do me a favor and stay in your seat until then, or you'll get us both in trouble."
Kate laughed. "Sounds like a plan. I'll be good, I promise."
Over on the other side of the quad, Anne Cross was standing with a small group of the Valkyrie, trying not to feel self-conscious about the fact that she was all got up in her Order of the Ash finery again. Of course, in this crowd today, the real trick was not feeling underdressed.
The Valkyrie had pulled out all the stops and done themselves up in their Corps' really ancient uniforms, a style few of the current members had ever worn, and those so long ago that they could barely remember what the occasion had been. Beyond them, everyone here who had a dress uniform to wear was wearing it, and that, in Corwin Arnutina's circle, included several royal personages. The thought suddenly struck Anne as funny, and she laughed as she looked around the quad and tried to count up the guests who met that criterion. Next to her, Gunnar Brynjelfr, away from whom Anne had only just become able to tear her eyes, so amazing did she look in her ancient Asgardian garb, gave her a curious look. "What's funny?" she wondered. "It just occurred to me how many princesses are here," Anne said. "Look, there's Princess Jessica of Seleucia, and Crown Princess Amanda of Gamelon. Ashka Shannon is a princess of Jurai. Cousin Peregrine's father is Thane of the Shire," Aaron Stonefist put in. "I guess that counts," Anne agreed. Turning to Gunnar, she added, "And you're a princess of Bergheim, I've just remembered."
"Barely," Gunnar objected. "I'm like 29th princess of Bergheim. The place would have to get hit by a comet before I'd ever get anywhere near the throne."
"Doesn't matter, still a princess," said Anne airily. "Anyway, it's funny because of Utina. She's Prince of Sephiro because she decided when she was little that she wanted to be a prince instead of a princess. You know, rescue instead of being rescued and stuff. I wonder if it's ever occurred to her how many badass princesses she knows. That's why I was laughing."
"When you put it that way, it is pretty funny," said Gunnar after a moment's thought. "You'll have to point it out to her at the reception, see what she thinks."
"I might just do," Anne began. Then her voice trailed off as she stood looking in surprise at a group of people who had just arrived on the quad. She had noticed the paramilitary-looking girls in green and black the day before, but hadn't paid them much mind. With all the august personages on campus for this occasion, security details were going to be a fact of life. Amanda Dessler had, in addition to Rena Dragonar, who would have been invited in any event, a brace of her Romulan guardsmen with her, for instance, and though they were keeping a very low profile to avoid invoking the princess's wrath, there had to be at least two agents of the Royal Seleucian Crown Protection Service around. It took Anne a moment to realize that these 10 must be those girls, because they looked dramatically different now. They were still dressed in black armor over green, but where before the green had been modern battle fatigues, and the armor high-tech composite of some kind, they now wore curiously elegant emerald green robes, kimonos, in fact, under intricately constructed armor that looked like it was made from panels of lacquered wood. Each wore a katana through her broad, elaborately knotted obi, and each had a subtly unique golden headdress upon her painstakingly coiffed head. Most striking of all, they were all made up like kabuki players, stark white face paint with bold red lips and accents over the eyes, their eyebrows exaggerated black slashes. They hadn't been sporting that look when Anne had noticed them earlier. Coupled with the very upright and confident way in which they carried themselves, the makeup gave them a fierce and dauntless aspect. In spite of their obvious youth, the oldest one, the auburn-haired girl who was evidently their leader, couldn't have been more than a year or so older than Corwin, and the others seemed to range down to not much older than Anne herself, they gave every appearance of being an elite and formidable little force.
"Wow," said Anne. "I wonder who they are."
"Oh, hey, cool," said Gunnar. "Kyoshi warriors. Somebody important from Dicho must be here."
Anne blinked. "Dicho? That's... Oh!
What?
See the woman over there talking to Chief Griffin and Skuld?"
Gunnar looked, nodded. "The one in blue?"
"Her name's Cora. We talked for a while last night.
She said she's from Dicho. She's what they call the Avatar.
Gunnar's eyebrows shot up.
Yeah, okay. That's about as important from Dicho as you get. Dang. What brings her here?
She and Corwin go way back, apparently. Anne smiled, enjoying the rare sensation of knowing something about Corwin that one of the Valkyrie didn't.
Gunnar disappointed her slightly by greeting that revelation with a shrug and a, well, that figures. But it was still a pretty enjoyable moment.
How do you know about the... what did you call them?
Kyoshi warriors, Gunnar told her. They come from an island called Kyoshi, hence the name. We've got a bunch of their alumnae in Valhalla. Master swordswomen, Tessen jutsu experts, great free runners. They're good times.
She caught movement at the front and nodded to Anne.
Looks like they're calling us to order. You better get to your seat.
She leaned and gave her a quick kiss, careful not to smudge either party's makeup, then winked and enjoyed the little blush it raised as she went on.
I'll catch up with you later.
You better, said Anne with a grin, and then she went to take her seat.
The ceremony itself began without a lot of preamble, in keeping with the minimal fuss approach its planners had taken throughout. On the dot of 11 o'clock, as the bells of Tensho Academy sounded the hour from the White Tower some distance behind the seated guests, Corwin and Utina appeared, together, in the grand doorway of the Academy's main building, still named, in honor of the school's original founder, Otori Hall. Off to the side, the brass section struck up a triumphal fanfare. It hadn't taken much consideration for Utina and Corwin to decide what to wear the second time around. They were both keeping the fantastic clothes Corwin's Aunt Belle had made for their first attempt in their respective arsenals, against some future ultra-formal wear contingency. But for this version, it was obvious to both of them early on that they should wear the highest level of Sephirian finery they could find. In Corwin's case, this was his black and silver rune knight's armor, in its most advanced and ceremonial form, painstakingly polished and fettled until its every surface and buckle gleamed. At his side he wore Ragnhildr, the Danann Ironbridge sword Utrina had commissioned for his wedding gift, and at his throat, fastening his armor's rich black cloak with its circuit tracery lining, was the silver rose Utrina had given him 2 days after first meeting him, on the first Christmas Eve she'd known him. For her part, Utrina had dusted off the Rose Prince's traditional uniform, the same one she'd worn for her first wedding, and, a bit unwittingly, the evacuation of Kronos. Then frowned at it, called Anthean, and made some modifications. It was still white, trimmed in touches of scarlet and black, a very similar color scheme to the one favored by Corwin's mother, coincidentally enough, and still had the jacket in the time-honored Tensho Academy style. But the red-lined cape was longer and fuller than before, and, to the mild surprise of everyone present, she'd dispensed with the trousers in favor of the sleek, knee-length skirt and black tights she'd worn as part of her Valhallan ensemble on the first attempt. She had the Valkyrie shock cap gloves on, too, and the same modestly heeled shoes, and her Asgardian wedding crown. Like Corwin, she wore a sword, her part of the sword exchange they'd performed after their Babylon 6 ceremony had dissolved in the confusion of the Tau Ceti incident. Another pair of figures descended the stairs from the forest, meeting them in the clear area at the stairs' base. One was Anthe. For this version of the ceremony, conducted here in the realm of which she was High Priestess, she couldn't possibly have escaped some involvement in the proceedings, as she had in the Midgardian attempt. Like the bride and groom, she wore clothing few present had ever seen her in before, rich, elaborately draped and folded robes, in a combination of smoky blue-gray and midnight blue. She, too, wore a crown,
one wrought from mystic roses symbolizing the 6 traditional sorcerous elements of the 10th world. With a beaming smile, she greeted them both, first clasping Utina's hands and kissing her, then doing the same to Corwin. The other person who descended from the forest to meet the wedding couple was a tall, slim but broad-shouldered, elegant but somehow indefinably tough-looking blonde woman, whose fur-edged finery put many in mind of the various maternal relatives of Corwin, who were seated up forward on the left side of the gathering. She wouldn't have looked out of place among the Valkyrie, even on this day. It was this woman, not Anthy, who spoke, as the rest of the wedding party, those who had served as Corwin's and Utina's attendants the first time, arranged themselves in a curving line behind the couple. "Good morning, everyone," she said, her voice pleasant and sturdy, like its owner. "My name is Presea. I am the Master Smith of the 10th world. My craft, my art, my responsibility, and my privilege in this world is the making of fine, strong, beautiful, and functional things. As such," here she smiled a little archly, "you can probably guess why Lady Anthy called upon me to bear witness here today." "But truly," she went on after the quiet murmur of laughter had rippled its way around the quad, "my purpose here, for all that it's symbolic and appropriate, is also a bit of a fiction." This got faint sounds of consternation from a few, sage nods from others, and she went on, "because I'm not really here to make anything today. We are not here to witness the creation of anything. Rather, we've all gathered to acknowledge, to celebrate, what already is. A fine, strong, beautiful, functional thing that made itself." Corwin and Utina, smiling privately, turned to face each other. Raising their right hands, they linked them together as if they were about to arm wrestle. Presea stepped back to make way for Anthy. With quick movements, her long fingers deft and precise, the High Priestess drew a long, narrow strip of something flexible from her sleeve and tied their hands together with a handsome and elaborate knot. "Corwin Ravenhair, Utina Tenjo," said Anthy, her voice soft but perfectly clear to everyone present, her tone kindly but ever so slightly fey. Next to Griffin at the front, Anthy's niece Raven felt a chill rush up her spine. She'd never heard her aunt's witch voice before, and she recognized it instantly. But for the different natural timbres of their voices, it was very like her own. Corwin and Utina nodded to Anthy in turn as she spoke their names, still smiling, and she went on, "Master Smith Presea speaks the truth. The two of you are already bound together with a tie far beyond any we might convince ourselves we can create in a simple ceremony." She put her right hand on Corwin's shoulder. "You are the pillar of the 10th world," she said, then placed her left hand on Utina's shoulder and continued, "and you are the prince, the pillar's strong right arm. Your destinies run on parallel tracks, regardless of anything we say or do here today." Her smile becoming faintly indulgent, Anthy went on in a less formal, more personal tone, "and you were lovers. Lovers in the purest, most beautiful sense. Long before he who would be the pillar ever set eyes upon the world whose happiness he would come to embody." As both parties reddened slightly and gave the priestess slightly sheepish smiles, Anthy expected they'd have put their hands behind their heads if they hadn't been tied together, she raised her voice to address the full gathering again and said, "So there will be no inquisition this day. To ask you now, whether you intend to love, cherish, defend, and support one another for the rest of your days would be folly. However, as your High Priestess, I would be remiss if I did not ask this one thing of you.
Do you both, as Pillar and Prince, truly believe, without question or shadow of doubt, that the strength of your bond will make stronger in turn the world for which we three share responsibility? With the kind of smile that said he took the matter very seriously, but was still all-encompassingly happy, Corwin looked her in the eye and replied, "Yes, I do." Anthy turned her intent but kindly gaze to Utrina, who was reminded powerfully of strange and elder times. But she, too, was smiling seriously as she answered without hesitation, "Yes, I do." The priestess held her gaze upon the prince for a moment, turned it back to the pillar, and then smiled upon them both. "Then I am content," she said, and, stepping back and to the side, she gestured elegantly for Presser. "Master Smith," she said, "do your duty." Presser stepped into position, placing both her hands over Corwin and Utina's lashed together ones, and the magically sensitive members of the audience felt the tingle and prickle of a nearby working as the Master Smith, the Pillar, and the Prince all closed their eyes and were surrounded by a beautiful golden light. Her face set in a look of intense concentration. Presea bowed her head over their hands, murmuring low in an ancient tongue. The glow brightened, spiking with a shimmering sound. The brand on Corwin's forehead and the Aesir mark carefully painted upon Utina's shone brightly with the sound. As the marks lit up, so too did the strap with which Anthy had bound their right hands together. With a yellow-orange glow like molten iron, but without evident heat, it seemed to melt and flow, pulling down away from their hands and reshaping itself into brilliant bands encircling their right wrists. Presea opened her eyes and, stepping back, removed her hands. As she did, the glow dimmed and faded, leaving in its place not the ceremonial tie, but a broad, gleaming band of some lustrous silvery metal around each wrist. Corwin and Utina raised their hands a little and regarded these new symbols thoughtfully for a moment. Then, lowering them, they leaned together with their hands still linked between them, and shared a long and soulful kiss that struck some of their onlookers as curiously chaste, considering. With a vaguely indulgent smile, Anthy waited for them to finish, then turned them to face the crowd of their friends and well-wishers, declaring, "Ladies and gentlemen, your prince and your pillar." On cue, the orchestra's brass struck up a different fanfare, also triumphal, perhaps even more so, and rampantly, indomitably cheerful. Pink-faced and beaming, the two walked back toward Otori Hall through the cheering, applauding throng. When they reached the path leading off the quad proper, they found it lined on either side with uniformed people, the Valkyrie, numerous duelists, certain of the Einherjar, many of Corwin's relatives, all of them with a kind of cheerful solemnity, forming the longest sword arch Corwin thought he'd ever seen for them to pass under. At the far end, hustling into position with the precision and grace for which they were renowned throughout their homeworld, were the Kyoshi warriors, their katana arched with edges upward. When they reached the end, the last two of the Kyoshi, the most senior, Maki, and the most junior, Izumi, abruptly lowered their swords, crossing them in front of the couple and halting their progress. Corwin was slightly surprised by this. It was traditional, but somehow he doubted the Kyoshi warriors, of all people, held with the archaic and patronizing act which customarily followed it. He looked curiously at Maki, on his left, and was startled to see that, though smiling as broadly as anyone here, she was also crying, tears streaming down her face. He'd never realized their makeup was waterproof. He had only a moment to register that before she leaned forward and kissed him, murmured congratulations in his ear, then resumed her place. On the other side, Izumi wasn't crying and didn't kiss Utina, but she did lean in to offer more formal congratulations
and press a small object into her hand. Their work done, the two warriors raised their blades to let the couple pass.